Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
It's time for today's Lucky Land Horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, John Schwab here from Curtain Call, and welcome to episode 98 of the Curtain Call Theater Podcast, the podcast that brings you backstage as close as you possibly can be, often while the shows are actually happening, to meet the people that make that theater happen. You can find all our episodes on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other fine podcast streaming services, and if you have a spare 30 seconds, please rate and review the podcast on whichever platform you use to help us be more discoverable to listeners who haven't heard about us yet. And now for this week's podcast. Our next guest you may have heard when I brought you the bonus episode of the podcast called Cargo way back in July 2016. I got to share the stage with Millie Thomas, who played Joey in that production of Cargo at the Arcola Theater. And it's no coincidence that a play concerning human trafficking in a dystopian future, taking its inspiration from the experiences of those in the Cali jungle, all the while with Brexit and the rise of Trump, in the daily news, you know, as a background. Well, it's no coincidence that the company became extremely close, and we remain extremely close friends today. I have followed Millie's rise as a playwright and actor to be reckoned with. I mean, she's gone from success to success, immediately following her star performance in Cargo with a sellout run of her play Dust at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, in which she wrote and starred in it and still stars in it today. Now, Millie doesn't pull any punches in either her acting or her writing, and Dust tackles the issue of depression and suicide head-on with no apologies. The issue of mental health and the stigmas surrounding it have been brought to the fore recently by the news of the suicides of prominent musicians such as Dolores O'Riordan from the Cranberries, Chris Cornell of Soundgarden and Avicii, as well as the highly public suicide of Robin Williams. And that was just as shocking to those who knew him well as to all of us who were just fans of a man who we all remember as someone who just did nothing but make us laugh. And watching a play about suicide where a young girl takes her own life, and there's no spoiler alert that it's the start of the play. It starts the play. I mean, you wouldn't expect to laugh, but you do. And straight away, and that is the genius of Dust. Which is currently running at Trafalgar Studios too. This is a play that challenges you to keep watching, even though that, you know, what you are watching is so painful that it brings you to tears. And, you know, and why shouldn't you cry as well as laugh? You should, in my opinion. And that's why you need to go see the show. And that's why I really needed to talk to Millie, and talk to her about the genesis of the show Dust, and its journey to the West End from Edinburgh, you know, via Soho Theatre, and all of the emotions that are kind of contained within. And this is one of my favorite chats I've ever had. It's an utterly honest chat. It's one that I hope you will enjoy and take as much from it as I did. And there's some swearing in this, so if you are listening in front of children, as well as the subject matter about taking one's life, it may not be suitable for them. But, you know, if you're in the car with kids, maybe save this one for later. And if you're at work, get back to work, man. Anyway, have a listen. Where do you want to start? Do you want to start at the beginning? Do you want to start about the genesis of the play? Or like,
yeah,
I can do.
I
know it was Edinburgh, wasn't it?
Did it go to Edinburgh? Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was Edinburgh last year.
And it was a weird one because I'd had the idea a very long time before, but I'd been very frightened of the idea. And I think because I knew that I was going to perform it, I put it off and off and off. And then I went up to the Fringe in 2016 and I was looking at the row of, like, I was standing in front of a massive row of posters and I just thought that you have no excuse for yours not being there. Like, pull your finger out.
Yeah.
It's just fear. And I think I had a sort of mad year of doing things that really, really frightened me. And it was only like the following September when it was all, you know, when the show had been up and it was a success, inverted commas, that I suddenly sort of took an out breath and was like, oh, yeah. That was scary.
I mean, I have never done Edinburgh. I've produced a show at Edinburgh, never performed in a show at Edinburgh. I produced a show that, you know, luckily had a big Hollywood actor in it, so it was quite easy, and it was a one-man show, so it was quite easy to sell, because, you know, the Guardian and the Scotsman and everything, they did their interviews with them, and it was fine, it was easy. I've also been up there as a theater goer and seen, you've just said, you know, why shouldn't the dust poster be there? That's a hell of a leap, and you know, we'll get into what the show is to you and things, but especially with this show, which isn't like, come, this is a laugh riot, it's a comedy, you know? That's even more of an achievement to have a success in inverted commas or whatever that word means to anybody at Edinburgh. So, you know, not only did you take the plunge with going to Edinburgh with the show, but also this show. How did you, in Edinburgh, because I know there are lots of people who do listen to the podcast who have had shows up there, how did you rise to the top or you know, smash your way through the chatter, endless chatter up there?
You know what? This is so, so unhelpful. But I just don't know. Like, we had PR.
Yeah.
I'd be very, you know, clear about that. Like, we work with Chloe Nelkin. Mm-hmm. I think she's incredible.
She's great.
And you know, she's done nearly all of my plays thus far, and so she gets me and knows my work, and so was very willing to take a leap of faith when we didn't have a script going up on the train because it still wasn't finished. But she was like, she'd worked with me before, so we have that shorthand, which is great. But then when we got there, I think word of mouth, really, for the first few. We were nearly full for the first two performances. Then we had some reviews come out, and the first review was a 3-star that really knocked my confidence, and I was a real wobble. And then later that day, a 5-star came out, and it's a very cynical game in Edinburgh. You know, the luxury. You hear actors in London all the time go, darling, I don't read reviews. And you think, well, lucky you. You know, when you're not doing your own...
Well, yeah, when you're your own agent, PR, producer.
Yeah. When you're a one-man band,
yeah.
You cannot afford not to.
Yeah, of course.
So you've got to, like, you're absorbing all these potentially damaging things, looking for the best pull quotes, but at the same time knowing you've got to, like, pour yourself back into a bodysuit and go and do it again in a couple of hours. But I think then we were selling out like 3 days in advance. And then it was just sort of selling out night by night, and then to the point where we were then completely sold out for the run. And it was a weird thing because I don't know if you heard this, we never got to finish it because the ceiling caved in. The ceiling of our venue caved in.
No.
And no one told us. So then I turned up to do the show.
Yeah.
And some guy went, I can't get in to see your show. And I was like, oh, I'm really sorry. Thinking, you know, we're talking about like box office nonsense. No, lucky old me.
Yeah.
And he was like, no, your ceiling's caved in. Like, what? And he's like, it was a real shock. But so then it felt like this weird incomplete thing because in my head I was sort of like, I've got two more of this weird experience that sort of felt like a baptism of fire and sort of outing myself, and also that weird thing where you're like, I say outing myself in the glibest sense in terms of like, that's how it felt. That was the only thing I could relate it to on the way up on the train.
Yeah.
It's like, if this isn't a smash success, I've basically let my parents know that I'm not doing okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's how it felt, and I just felt full of guilt for that. But then I thought, that fear, that's why we need to make the show. That's why we have to. But it was still a feeling that I had to acknowledge nonetheless. Mm. But then, you know, so it was this weird... It was a really bittersweet month, because also it meant, speaking very frankly, we were doing well, which meant that no one really wanted to hang out with us, because the whole point of Edinburgh is you band together, right? I've done it. I've done it for years on end, where you want to go and drink with the people who are also having a shit time.
Really suffering.
Yeah. So then you go and have fun.
So
then no one wanted to hang out. And then I was single... and trying to go on dates, and then they were Googling the show and going, oh, I'm actually busy.
Oh, my Lord.
And so it was a really weird, isolating Edinburgh where I was doing all these interviews for the PR thing, and then I had another play up there at the same time, so I'd never taken my own writing before, and then I took two plays at once.
As you do.
Which was nuts and really stupid. And I'd programmed them at the same time so that I couldn't go in and watch, because then I thought, once I'm up in Edinburgh, I'm an actor, and that's what it's going to be. And then doing all these interviews where I wasn't able to see the other show, and we'd had to make loads of weird cuts... So then they were talking about a show I hadn't seen that I had to sort of be like, oh, yeah, no, that was a choice. That was a definite choice. Thinking, I have no idea what bit you mean.
And I honestly think you should have, like, we'll come back next July, Millie, and do, or June, and do a what to do at Edinburgh or not to do
Edinburgh. Oh, my God. That is its own thing, isn't it? I feel like.
When you came out, did you think up there that I'm going to take this to Soho Theatre straight away, or... I mean, did you...
I was hoping that it would have a life beyond Edinburgh. I was really hoping for that. And we were lucky we had offers. But it wasn't like an open, shut decision. And it was that thing where, like... I think the hardest thing was because we were compared to Fleabag all the time.
Yeah.
And that happens inevitably because there's a lack of representation. Mm. So then any sort of... vaguely posh white woman saying rude things every now and again is, as far as they're concerned, is Phoebe Waller-Bridge.
Yeah.
And so, but then we also had to use that in our marketing, because otherwise people weren't going to come.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So then it's this weird thing of like...
You have to name...
We have to name names, but at the same time, no one wants to name names. Yeah. But then that meant that that was sort of the assumed trajectory for the show.
Yeah.
And I think... It was the right decision because the space honoured the show in a really lovely way.
Yeah.
I was saying, actually, I realised the other week that the more high profile the show has got, the closer the audience have got.
Yeah.
And it's really weird that they've got closer and closer.
They're
the
close
rooms.
Here.
Yeah. I mean, whites of their eyes. And it's just weird that the show has got, while it's got bigger, physically it's got smaller and smaller and smaller. And... beforehand it felt in Edinburgh it felt very tomb-like in those caves and ghostly and drippy and cold, and then Soho it felt quite slick, and here it feels almost unbearably intimate.
I mean, this, like, technically, let's go there. As an actor, have you had to change, you know, how you approach Alice? Like, is there a way that... Because you can bring it right down. And you did. I mean, you know, I watched it last night. So, you know, I was able to. And there were just little asides that were so brilliantly just where I thought, oh, God, that was for me. And it wasn't for me. It was for everyone. But like, you know.
Yeah, thing is, here I can do that because I can see you all. And you're all on three sides. And the mirrors at the back kind of make it almost like it's in the round.
Yeah.
And so it's a really... I have been able to bring it down, and I feel like in Soho I didn't quite have that luxury, and so a lot of the comedy felt very You know that thing, it's that age-old thing, like, you do it in drama school, like, you see it all the time. Like, you get first year of drama school, and you put kids on a massive stage, and they're like, oh, but I'm going to have to shout for them to hear me. And then they're like, well, no, we're here to learn technique, and we're here to learn all these really practical things, so you can actually be heard in a cross-arch theatre, right at the back, but still say something with intensity, or not feel like you're shouting. And I guess I sort of overcame that in Soho as a combination of either having like little to no technique, but just Alice became really direct, I guess. Mm. And in Edinburgh, you know, you are dealing with sound bleed because of the nature of the game.
Yeah.
So it just, she was just very like, here I am, matter of fact, quite loud.
This happened.
Yeah, just that slight, you know, like, just that difference in like a conversational volume. And then like people who just like, you know, like they just talk, and it's really, really slightly jarring. But then it becomes almost like, I don't know, it almost feels quite calculated now to look back, because it is funny. It's a funny way of talking.
Yeah.
And then you think, are you lulling the audience into a false sense of security? I don't know, in order to like rip the rug out from under them.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think I'm trying to imagine. I didn't get to see it, so look at full disclosure. Mm. You and I have previous.
Yes,
you know, we have previous. You know, so I was coming to, you know, watch. I wanted to go watch it at Soho. Had plans to go, and you know, as actors, as we, you know, something always happens.
Yeah.
Like, literally, something goes, so I've got a gig filming. I was like,
I want a job, book a holiday.
Exactly. Exactly. And so when this came back, I was like, I'm not missing it. And, you know, we got to come last night with some of your former colleagues. I mean, we've heard you before. We did a podcast for Cargo.
Yes.
This was ages ago. So this is about 2 years down the line.
Yeah. So that would have been a month before I made the decision to write it.
That's insane. That's insane. So it, you know, I have, but knowing the space in Soho, now I see, I'm imagining Edinburgh and Soho now here, I just think this is a good fit. This is a good play for intimacy as well.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I watched people lean in, which is incredible. You know, I said at the beginning, before we start recording, I'm not going to blow sunshine up your ass. Really. Even though we're friends, I'm not going to do it. But I watch people leaning in. And when you have them leaning in a space where it's this intimate, you know you cracked it. So, you know, when you went to write this piece, and we can talk as much about it, the content, or as little as you'd like, you know, but it is a very challenging piece. It's very brutally open and honest and fearless in both its writing and execution. When you were writing it, did you have it in your head that that's how you were going to portray it? You know, did you imagine it in a bigger space, or in a space like this? Because it may, again, I'm going back to people leaning in a space like this is a frickin' achievement. They're not just sitting back and going, okay, this play is happening. Literally leaning forward. I know people use literally all the time. Literally leaning forward.
It's interesting, you know, it was such a tricky play to get out that I just didn't think. Like, I honestly hadn't thought that far ahead. Like, we looked at venues for Edinburgh and just thought, right, that one, like, here, let's rank them in order, just in terms of, like, actual capacity, size, what we're aiming for. And then this will give us a sort of something that feels sort of more theatrical with wing space. It was literally that practical, because I couldn't write it. Mm-hmm. And I've never had writer's block like it. But it, you know, I'd never had writer's block before. I'd never found it hard to write stuff. I could always generate material. I just couldn't edit for shit. And so, like, I found that tough. And then it came to writing it. I had no idea where it was going. It would come out of me like in ugly bursts, and then I'd have to send it to Sarah, our director, and go, okay, well, here's this. But usually it was her emailing me saying, okay, I'm not freaking out. Like, clearly freaking out, but not. Like, I'm not freaking out. It's been a couple of days and I've heard nothing. I'm going to set you an exercise. Like, for an example, I wrote 9 endings because I couldn't end it. I didn't know how to end it at all. and everything felt wrong. And it was such a overwhelming responsibility with a play like this and subject matter like this. You think how that last line of this play has got to be so important, and it's got to say everything you want to say while still feeling, you know, within the realm of the world. And that freaked me out, and so I couldn't do it. I sobbed in Oaxaca one day, and this waitress brought me a taco, and I wrote
and a
like
shot of tequila.
And like 9 endings, and I was like sat there like churning out all these endings, and she was like, "Are you okay?" And I was like, "No, I'm not okay. I can't end this play." But then it got to that point where I then handed everything over to Sarah and basically went into that rehearsal room as though I were an actor for hire on a job. Because I had no idea how it was going
to
look.
But it's hard to
separate yourself. But like, I didn't get a say in the design.
Yeah.
Like stuff like that, which I think is right.
Right.
Because I just thought, I'm so in this that it's going to, you know, so I sort of, it ate into rehearsal time, the script. We only had 7 days.
That made my bumhole pucker a little
bit. It's terrifying. It makes me feel sick. Because, like, we literally were, like, just going through. We spent the first, like, 3 days of rehearsal then actually refining the script. And then we did a preview that was script in hand. And everyone was like, "This is fucking brilliant." And I was like, "Oh, great. Such a relief. So happy." I hadn't learned it because we were literally writing it up until that day.
Yeah.
I did it in jeans and a t-shirt with no set or lights. We just literally just walked around the space with the script in hand to a full house. And then someone took me aside and went, "Yeah, it was an hour and 20. Like, are you shitting me? Why did no one tell me that you let me, like, dance away in my little, like, reverie? And everyone sat there going, "Fuck, we've got to tell her.
Yeah.
She's got to lose 20 minutes for Edinburgh."
Yeah.
And it just became this. And then we got the joy of being able to put some of that back in for Soho and then here. So
It just felt... as an audience member, it was as long as it needed to be.
Yeah.
And that's a great thing.
Any longer, you're like, "Get me out of this room."
Although I'm saying, okay, so, you know, listen, it is, the subject matter is, the girl is taken out of love. Okay. And, I mean, that is apparent straight away. First, lights up, you know, and... And so, the world you've created, though, is not this morose. You know, there is a person... That says, "Oh, hello." You know, this is a person that has just performed this horrible act on themselves, like, because they you find out why, you know, this the pain that they're in and the pain and the suffering. And I mean, it really did slay me, and only because it was fucking true. And I think that, you know, I don't think that people should be afraid of this play at all. I think that, you know, it's really a play that people should see. You know, challenge yourselves to come and see, because it does speak the truth. And there is a person behind this pain. It's really astonishing. And I think with you... I suppose the question I want to ask is, like, you know... You mentioned that you were kind of bearing on. Your parents might go, "Oh my God, my daughter's not okay." You know, you have to get up there and perform this every night, and speak your truth and lay it out there. When you set out to do it, you know, was there an end game for you, or were you just writing a play? Was this the short question is, was there a purpose to this play other than, "I need to get this out"? Is it, "I want to help people. I need to shine a light on this dark subject"? I mean, that's...
Yeah.
Is that wanky? I don't know.
No. It isn't. And, like, I think it's a weird one, because I think there is a weird Venn diagram at play, I think, because of the nature of Edinburgh. I think if you take Edinburgh out of it, because Edinburgh ultimately is the single largest trade fair for our profession.
Yeah.
That's what it is. And I hate that it's that.
Yeah.
But that's exactly what it is. Yeah. And I think a lot of people assume that when you're doing a one-woman show, it people call it a career move. And I find that very cynical.
Mm.
There's an element of truth to it, sure, because it's a story that I wanted to tell. In the plainest terms, it's a story I wanted to tell, and it's something that had really bothered me. And I don't really like doing stuff that doesn't, like, light a fire under my ass. So, like, but then also, I find the representation of suicide ideation and depression in art and pop culture, I find it abhorrent and romanticized and glamorized and gross. And I really wanted to tell a story that took that concept, the idea that you get to be this like sexy, you know, disembodied third person narrator in your own life, and tip that on its head. And so that's why I'd said to people, she is dead, she's died. Because I find it irresponsible playing with this notion of attempts.
Yeah.
Because attempts often do happen, and they are often botched, and they are often, you know, not, they don't have the outcome that the original person making that attempt intended them to have.
Yeah.
But if you see that on television, you're never going to... The Samaritans taught me this. You're never going to make anyone fear suicide or feel suicidal in talking about suicide.
Yeah.
If you ask someone, are you feeling suicidal? It can often actually alleviate the worry because you've said it out loud. So suddenly it's not as large in your own head. It suddenly feels a lot smaller. That can happen, and that's often the case.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to really, really look at that, I guess. Like, use the play to sort of... I hadn't seen any depressed characters on television that looked like me or reminded me of me.
Yeah.
And while I'm not Alice, there is a bit of Alice in me, but I'm not her. But it feels almost like the concept of being high functioning has passed most British television by.
Yeah. It's great that somebody can, if they're feeling anything, if they need to hear or speak. I just think it's important, really. I honestly think you've written a very important piece. And you know, if I can ask, you know, in your own words, when people come to see this, what would you like them to get? Or what is, when they leave, because I didn't leave upset, I didn't leave down, I didn't leave anything. I was really uplifted. I felt
great. Oh, I'm pleased. I mean, I think... What I really want is, if the one takeaway, I think, is please don't kill yourself.
Yeah.
It can't be the answer. You know, all that's happened is in a person who has suicide ideation, your mind and body are no longer working together. Your mind and body are no longer working as one.
The disconnect is real.
Exactly. And when our fridge breaks, we buy a new fridge.
Yeah.
But when our mind breaks, the mind tries to buy a new body.
Mm.
And it doesn't work that way. And there's always... suicide is the removal of hope. Like, you've got no capacity for hope once that's happened. And I just really want us, I guess, to become more collective as a society with how we talk about it, how we address it, what we can actually do, and being honest about what we can do. Like, if you say to someone, oh, call me anytime, and then they call you and you're like, oh, but I'm having dinner, don't offer.
Yeah.
And it's really simple. It's really, like, if you're not well enough to listen, that's fine. It's just really, really practical stuff. Like, what can we practically do? And can we be more open about it? And can we... Because I think there is a lot of talk about stigma bashing, and I do think that's important. And removing the stigma means it's less likely to happen because we're talking about it. But we've got to listen as well. We can't just talk about talking.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay. Final question.
Yes.
Before I let you go. Is there a life beyond Trafalgar 2 for Dust?
watch this space.
I say I love that answer.
Okay.
Final question. What should somebody do? Like, I think that's important to end this, like, with what should somebody do? Like,
okay.
People should know.
Okay. So there are different options. You can always go to your local branch of Samaritans. Mm. I didn't know this, but they do physical one-to-one sessions.
Oh, right.
So essentially, they're a walk-in. They operate as a drop-in.
Mm.
And I had no idea that you could do that. And that's, I think, a brilliant thing. Also, if you want to take yourself to your local A&E, if that is an option.
Mm-hmm.
If you're on your own and you don't feel it's an option, calling, emailing, texting the Samaritans, or someone on 111 or 999, mm. To talk. And the reason I keep banging on about the Samaritans, well, we're partnered with them. I've been a service user in the past. It doesn't have to be life or death. They're always there to listen. And they legally cannot give you any advice. So they can't tell you what to do.
Mm.
But often the fact that you talking or you guys to having a conversation about something to not to do with anything...
Yeah.
It can really just release that pressure valve and often make you feel well enough to a point where you might then be able to take yourself to A&E or take yourself into a session.
Yeah.
They are also completely confidential because I know stigma is still a huge thing. They never show up on your phone bill. They don't even get your details in the office. If they wanted to call you back, they couldn't.
Mm.
All your details are scrambled on a screen before they get there, which I think is amazing. So that way they have that system in place. For example, say you're in an abusive relationship,
yeah.
and you don't want to know, it's not on
yeah.
your phone bill.
Yeah.
It's not there.
Great.
So that's a good thing. And it's worth actually making, on days where you are feeling okay, making a list for yourself about what options you do have in place. I know that sounds nuts, but I started doing it. I was on a flight. I've not told anyone this. I was on a flight. And the lady started doing the safety demonstration. I ignore this every time. And today I'm going to listen. And I listened and I was like, ah, okay. And I was like, why don't I have one of those for me? Where are all my exits? Where are my exits? Where are all my things?
Yeah.
Just so that
yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
Because sod's law, that'll come round and you're not well enough to do anything.
Yeah. Well, we all need an oxygen mask from time to time. Millie Thomas, you're amazing.
Stop.
come see us. Yeah, no, I'll put all this in the show notes and put things in.
Lovely.
When does the show finish?
13th of October.
Get down here, people. Seriously.
Oh, thank you.
Millie Thomas there, actor and writer of Dust, playing at the Trafalgar Studios 2 until the 13th of October. Now, before we wrap up, if you are a theater professional, head on over to curtaincallonline.com and sign up for a free profile page. All you have to do is create an account with an email address, make up a cool password, away you go. Start connecting, find jobs, find out about all kinds of shows, including Dust. Who worked on Dust? Go on curtaincallonline.com, search up Dust. You'll find everyone who worked on the show. You can follow us on all the socials, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Curtain Call. That's Curtain Call, all one word. We'd love to hear from you if you have any suggestions or feedback for the podcast. Get in touch with me via any of the social media platforms I just mentioned or write to me at john@curtaincallonline.com. And it just leaves me to say a huge thank you to Millie Thomas and all her peeps from Dust playing at the Trafalgar Studios until the 13th of October. Go see the show, guys. Like, it is vitally important. Visit the Trafalgar Studios website for tickets. And if you struggle with depression or you know someone who does, please don't sit back and hope things will change. Give the Samaritans a call on 116-123 in the UK or 116-123 in the Republic of Ireland. They're there to listen, and talking is the solution. I will put all this information in the show notes. Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the Curtain Call Theater Podcast, and I will catch you all next week. Bye.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org. Because only together we rise.
It's time for today's Lucky Land Horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.